take that fellow down under. Thank you very much, pal. Appreciate it, Mr. Prime Minister. I'm honored today to be joined by two of America's closest allies, Australia and the United Kingdom, to launch a new phase of the trilateral security cooperation among our countries. As Prime Minister Morrison and Prime Minister Johnson said, I want to thank you for this partnership, your vision as we embark together.
In 2021, a new alliance between the United States, Australia, and the United Kingdom was announced. Dubbed the AUKUS Agreement, the centerpiece for the plan was for the United States to build Australia new nuclear submarines to replace its aging fleet. Now, almost 3 years later, this plan has evolved, and with it, inevitably, has the budget expectations and the criticisms. This is Asia Rising, a podcast from La Trobe Asia at La Trobe University. Today on the program, is AUKUS a good deal for Australia? We'll be hearing from Professor Peter Dean, Director of Foreign Policy and Defence at the United States Studies Centre at the University of Sydney.
It was just over a year ago the government announced, or all three governments announced, what they called the optimal pathway, which is really the plan for Australia to acquire this capability. That started last year in 2023 with increased port visits of these submarines from the US in particular, but also the UK. Into 2023-24, into that period, we've seen the announcement only recently after AUKMIN of the design partner, BAE Systems, and the sustainment partner, the Australian Submarine Corporation, and the design for this SSN AUKUS boat we're going to build in Australia, but the UK are also going to build, is well underway. Eventually, we'll get to what we call in 2027 Submarine Rotational Force West, where there'll be a permanent rotation of US in particular, nuclear-powered conventionally armed submarines in the west of Australia. And one of the reasons for doing that is to build up Australia's nuclear stewardship and competency. So increasingly from that period, those boats will be there and also undertaking maintenance and sustainment work in Australia, which will get our workers, our workforce and our Navy prepared for when we do that for our own submarines. They will arrive in the early 2030s when Australia will be, quote, sovereign ready for conventionally armed nuclear-powered submarines. And this is when we'll get our first American Virginia-class submarines that we will purchase from the United States. That will allow us to do nuclear stewardship, as I said, the sustainment and maintenance on our own submarines, as well as those that are visiting. And that'll be somewhere between 2 to 5 American submarines. And then in the late 2030s, coming off the production line in Adelaide, will be the first of the AUKUS class SSNs, which will be the ones built in Australia, which will eventually will be the fleet going forward over the longer time. And in the background of all of this is our current class of submarines, the Collins class diesel electric submarines. They'll remain in service until they're steadily dropped off as the Virginia class arrive and then the AUKUS boats arrive. And some or all of them will have what we call a life of type extension to keep them in service, so we have no submarine capability gap. So it's quite a complex plan. It's got many moving parts.
Yeah.
But the moving parts are designed in a way that they're overlapping. So the reason it's 2 to 5 Virginia class submarines is because if everything's going well with the build of our own boats in Adelaide, we'll probably only need 2 of them. If those boats are delayed, or if we have problems with our Collins class boats, we could potentially get up to 5 to fill the gap. So this is all about ensuring we don't have a submarine capability gap in our defences for Australia.
So a couple of times in that explanation, which sounds great, and I think that there's so many moving parts that I think that there are a lot that people are concerned about.
Absolutely.
And a lot can go wrong. So initially, how much importance is put in Australia's submarine capacity when it comes to the defence of the country?
This is where the critical discussion kind of really should start, which is with strategy.
Yeah.
And what we're attempting to do. First thing I'll talk about is geography and the very simple notion that we're an island. We are, yes, a continent, but we're also an island. And we live in a region that is dominated by its maritime spaces. So the Indo-Pacific is our strategic environment that we live in. It's dominated by the Indian and Pacific Oceans. And that is now where the sort of contest for power in our globe is happening. It's where the majority of economic power in the world is coming from. And it's our home. This is the region that we live in. In the past, for instance, during the Cold War, The sort of strategic center of gravity for the world was in Europe in the competition in the Cold War. Now that competition, the majority of economic development and the majority of trade is happening in our region. And as that region is experiencing changing power dynamics and changing balances of power, it becomes really important for Australia to ensure its security. So the first thing we have to remember is we're an island. Mm. And the majority of our wealth comes through the import and export of resources, minerals, goods, and our trade and development. We are an international trading economy. And the majority of our fuel and petroleum and our energy comes into the country, and our food and, of course, our minerals and resources goes out through those trading and supply lines. So the sort of geographic nature of being an island and being in a maritime environment is really key. The second of all related to that is the strategy part. So Australia's strategy is an attempt to ensure that we have a regional strategic balance in the Indo-Pacific and that we positively contribute to that. Because Australia, along with the vast majority of states in the region, we call status quo powers. We like the situation where it is. We want to keep peace and stability and security.
Yeah.
And of course, what we do have in the region is one power in particular, China, who's a rising power, who is not a status quo power. It's a revisionist power. And they've been showing through their behaviour in the South China Sea and the East China Sea, what's been happening in Hong Kong and Xinjiang province and a whole range of other areas. And its interactions with the Philippines is a really good example around the second Thomas Shoal at the moment, that they're attempting to change that status quo. And they're willing to use force, coercion and military power to do so. And they've undertaken the largest military build-up of any country in the world since the Cold War era. And they're doing that without any transparency and with a leadership progressively saying that they're going to change that status quo by using force if they have to. So we're trying to balance that. As our Foreign Minister Penny Wong said, she can only do diplomacy if that's backed up by hard power as well. And that there is a military strategic balance in the region. And we're trying to ensure that as China grows and as it massively accelerating its military, that we help contributing to a balancing coalition that pretty much all other states in the region want. So the ASEAN states, for instance, are very keen to maintain sovereignty and to maintain the current status quo. So that's really important. As a part of that, we have adopted a military strategy, what we call deterrence by denial. It's basically a status quo type of strategic approach. And we want to do that in a self-reliant way. Yes, we have a partnership with the United States and alliance, and we work closely with other countries such as Japan and India and others in the region, Indonesia. But we want to do that in a self-reliant way. And because the risk is from a major power and the risk of major power conflict, we're looking within that strategy to having what we call asymmetric capability edges. So that's key technology areas in our defence system that are better than everybody else's. And then it makes it harder for anyone to coerce us or to imply their version or view of the region on us.
Yeah.
And because we're an island, because of the nature of the changing character of war, submarines are the most important single deterrent platform that we have and absolutely critical. And of course, the transformation from a conventional submarine to a nuclear submarine is basically going to what you would class as sort of the capital ship of modern navies. So in the past, battleships used to be the major warship that navies had. Then it was aircraft carriers. And into the future, most people are generally assessing that conventionally armed nuclear power submarine is that sort of modern capital warship. And what we know is that the country sharing that technology with us, principally the United States, but also the United Kingdom, that US submarines have a generation or two advantage over any potential adversary. So this is a high level of technology that's far out ahead of anybody else in our region or any potential adversary that we could face. So this will equip our defence force with a real high-end deterrent platform that will be the best of its type in the world. And that's critical because it's a submarine, the Navy's at the front line of what we do, and we're an island.
Yeah.
So I think it comes down to that. And there's a whole bunch of operational regions. So submarines are important. That's why we have Collins class. So Collins class, arguably the best conventional submarines in the world. But conventional submarines are getting more and more difficult to operate. Intelligence and surveillance and reconnaissance is making it easier to find them because they have to come to the surface quite regularly to recharge their batteries by drawing in oxygen and snorting, where a nuclear-powered submarine never has to do that. And nuclear submarines also have an advantage because of that nuclear reactor in range, speed, endurance, power, weapon systems, sensors, and critically stealth. While a diesel electric submarine can be quieter when it operates, the fact that the nuclear submarine does never have to come to the surface to snort, as they say, to draw in that air, it makes it much more stealthy. So it's a real leap in capability and advantage. And the other thing, to come back to the geography point, we are an island. We're a very big island. We have the third largest exclusive economic zone of any country in the world. And where we would like to operate those submarines to the north of Australia, into those choke points to our north and into the Indian and Pacific Oceans, the distances we have to travel are vast for our submarines. That's why Collins is the largest conventional submarine in the world. A nuclear submarine will be able to transit those distances much, much faster and stay there 3 to 4 times as long because of its nuclear reactor power. So it can stay on station and on mission and doing its tasks for as long as the food supply in the submarine and the crew endurance can go, where a diesel electric submarine is limited by its oxygen, but also by the amount of diesel fuel it can carry.
Okay.
So there's great operational advantages and strategic advantages to having a conventionally armed nuclear-powered submarine.
All right, let me tease out a couple of things there. And firstly, thank you for explaining that to a degree where myself, whose background knowledge on submarines is Sean Connery, not even trying with a Russian accent.
But what a great movie. Like, can we just interject there and say one of the best submarine movies of all time?
That's right, that's right. But that's my ground level. That's that and James Bond. Okay, so thank you. But there's many criticisms about AUKUS, so I'm going to throw a couple of them at you.
Yep.
This gets to the sovereignty issue, I think, that you said, and trying to be self-capable and
self-reliant,
is why not just have US forces, Navy, submarines, etc., based in Western Australia and essentially pay them for our defence a little bit, but not exactly as crudely put as that, but what South Korea do to some extent, what Japan does to some extent, is to leverage them and have them in our own backyard being the marshal. And that comes down to the sovereignty thing.
Yeah, it comes down to the sovereignty thing. And of course, sovereignty has been a big criticism that a lot of people have thrown around. You know, to name some big names, Malcolm Turnbull and Bob Carr and Paul Keating will put the sovereignty question on the table. Mm. I would say they have a very surface level view of what it means by sovereignty. First of all, yes, we're going to have to work in partnership with the United States and the United Kingdom to get this capability. But one of the benefits is that these will be submarines that are commanded by the Royal Australian Navy, under Royal Australian Navy command, and therefore under sovereign direction of the Prime Minister of Australia. And therefore, this capability will work in Australia's strategic interests and will work to achieve Australia's strategic objectives. Now, a lot of the time, because we're in a close partnership with the United States, for instance, those two things align, but they don't always align. And particularly in a conflict scenario, the requirements that we have for these submarines might be different from the United States. And if they're in the sovereign control of us, our interests will come first. If they're still under the sovereign control of the United States, well, obviously they'll direct them to their interests first and our interests second. So it actually enhances our sovereignty rather than diminishes from it. There is also very, very few countries who have complete and utter sovereignty, and including the United States doesn't really have it in terms of military capabilities. So if you look at the Joint Strike Fighter, the F-35, that's actually a coalition. It's into something like 18 or 19 nations now who are involved in the development of that capability. So the US has actually given up some sovereignty as a result of that as well. And this is the way this sovereignty has always worked. We strive for self-reliance within the alliance framework. To be self-reliant, we need to have a partnership with the United States to get access to technology we can otherwise not afford or develop on our own, but make them sovereign parts of our defence force. So therefore, the Australian government can make sovereign decisions about how we use them. And this has been a long-standing practice of what we call self-reliance within the alliance framework that goes way back to the 1970s. And of course, when Malcolm Turnbull was Prime Minister, when Paul Keating were Prime Minister, they know and believed and understood this, and that policy hasn't changed. And the same when Bob Carr was Foreign Minister. So there is really no difference from a capability point of view on the sovereignty levels in relation to our current Collins-class submarines as it is to our new nuclear-powered submarines we'll receive, with the exception that we won't be able to build the nuclear reactors. We'll have to rely on Rolls-Royce in the United Kingdom to do for us. But when they're delivered to us, they're sealed. We never have to open them up again. And we will have a sovereign capability to maintain and sustain them.
Yeah.
And that's where it is self-reliance, not self-sufficiency, but self-reliance. And very, very few countries in the world can do self-sufficiency, and a very small handful in the world. And as I said, even the United States is entering partnerships around capability development that they trade off some of their full self-sufficiency to get more economic efficiencies and to co-develop things with allies and partners.
Yeah, okay. So this brings up the question then of the investment that Australia is continuously not expected to make in developing AUKUS and getting us to our AUKUS end goal, but are willingly making, it seems. So there was a $3 billion investment into America's industrial capacity. There's been the recent, as you brought up, cash injection into Rolls-Royce.
Yep.
Is this kind of continual cash spending justified in your view? I mean, I know the end goal, part of it is sovereignty, as you say, and that this is the steps that we need to take, but they're very expensive steps that we're taking.
Yeah, absolutely. And look, I think first thing we've got to keep in mind is we should never forget that AUKUS was an Australian idea. So this was the Australian government who went to the United States and the United Kingdom saying, we've assessed that we need this capability. This is one of the most high-end capabilities in the world. The Americans have the best of this capability in the world. They've only ever shared it once before, which is with the United Kingdom in the 1950s. And we asked for it. We need to keep that in mind. So this is a request. Then the question is, what do we have to do to invest to ensure we can get that capability in return?
Yeah.
From the UK Rolls-Royce announcement last week, well, I think that's a very prudent investment because Rolls-Royce is going to build our nuclear reactors. And Rolls-Royce will simply say, okay, we produce X number of reactors a year. We don't have enough production capacity at the moment to produce X plus what we need for you. So you need to invest in our factory and production line to ensure you can get the reactors that you want. So this is a direct investment because we're buying reactors off Rolls-Royce for our submarines.
Yeah, yeah.
In a similar way, this is why we're directly investing in the US submarine industrial base. The US are attempting to lift their submarine industrial base for two reasons, for their own production capacity, but for ours as well. If you want to buy one of those, you're going to have to give us some money up front to invest in the production line so we can produce one for you down the end of the line in a few years' time.
Mm-hmm.
So we're investing. It's not a handout. It's not a subsidy. It's an investment into raising the production capability of Rolls-Royce to build our reactors for us and into the US industrial base so they can produce enough submarines, including selling 2 to 5 of them to us down the line.
Yeah.
So a lot of critics of AUKUS jumped on the fact that in the Pentagon's proposed budget for 24-25, they only ordered one submarine when they really need to be ordering 2.3. What they overlooked was, including the Australian contribution and some other money in the budget that just passed, the 23-24 budget, there is a $21.3 billion investment in the US submarine industrial base to produce enough submarines for them and for us.
Mm-hmm.
Of that $21.3 billion, $3 billion is an Australian contribution to that investment for our submarines. The other amount is the US directing into their own submarine industrial base. So we'll benefit from their massive injection as well, because our $3 billion alone would never get them there.
Yeah.
So it's a co-investment.
Okay. And we're a very small slice of that
pie. And we're a very small slice of that pie. Now, this introduced risks. I think we have to acknowledge that's not guaranteed.
Mm.
We have to acknowledge, like in any production capacity, there's a struggle for workers. There's a reason that they're spending all this money on the industrial base because they've let it decline too far in the sort of post-Cold War era.
Yeah.
And the war in Ukraine has demonstrated to all of us that industrial capacities in the Western world for most things, be it from armored vehicles to missiles to submarines, is not at the levels required to manage the strategic risks that we face.
All right. So in a similar vein then, can we talk about the Virginia class,
yep,
which seems to be engaged with as a kind of stopgap measure? This is what we're going to have in between,
yep,
and in the meantime to cover the gap of the Collins class submarine, which are becoming
exactly
older and out of date,
yep,
and working our way up to the AUKUS submarines. The argument against the question mark over the Virginia class is that the US don't have enough, yep, and that they need all that they can make. So why would they give, yep, any to Australia?
So I think, first of all, we need to go back to strategy. All this stuff is strategy-led. So what is the US strategy around this? So the US has a strategy that's defined in their strategic documents, which is called integrated deterrence. So like Australia, we want to deter any potential adversary from using military force to change the status quo or to change the regional strategic order, because it's much cheaper despite the very large volume of money that we talk about in peacetime defense spending, it's much better to, if we can, deter other states from conflict than we can to wait and then have to fight them. So if you look at defense spending in the history of Australia, it goes up inordinately when we have to fight a war. The key thing is, what do we have to spend in peacetime to maintain our own defenses, but hopefully deter? It's much cheaper to deter than it is to fight a war.
Yeah.
So they also have this deterrence by denial approach and strategic alignment. The US has realized that they cannot do that alone in the Indo-Pacific as the strategic balance of power shifts and economic power in particular shifts. So they have a strategy built on allies and partners, as is our strategy. And it's about empowering particularly their closest allies to have the tools to contribute to that collective deterrence.
Mm.
So it's actually a clearly defined part of US strategy to give countries like Australia and Japan critical military capabilities that will help them to do their own self-reliant defense and deterrence, which will also then contribute to the whole. So first of all, it's in the US strategic interest to do this.
Okay.
At a strategic level. Now, what we face is the tactical and operational level. A problem is, will the US have enough submarines for themselves, let alone sharing some submarines with us? And that's a bit of a debate inside the US at the moment. There's one former Trump administration official, Elridge Colby, who keeps saying publicly, well, we need to look at this. Maybe we shouldn't do this. The counter-argument to that is, even if the US is struggling to have enough for the demands that they're setting for themselves, by transferring that capability over to Australia, you are not diminishing the overall strategic balance in the region. In fact, you're enhancing it by empowering a critical ally of the United States to be more self-reliant in their own defence. But those submarines are not lost to the overall strategic balance. So even though the US will never be able to sovereignly direct what that submarine does, because of the alignment of strategic interests and objectives between Australia and the United States, it will still contribute to that overall balance.
Mm.
They may lose tactical control of that submarine and sovereign control of that submarine, but it's still contributing to mutual strategic objectives and interests in the region. And over the longer term, by empowering Australia through AUKUS and, say, Japan through selling them long-range missiles, they create to an overall stronger strategic balance. So there is an interest in it. Of course, we're paying for these submarines. They're not being gifted to us by the United States. We're co-investing, as we saw in the industrial base, and then we'll pay for them when we receive them.
Mm.
So it's not like the US are just giving it to us.
Yeah, yeah.
You know? Now, I said it's not without risk. The US, of course, have left a provision in the AUKUS agreement that passed their Congress that the US president will have to sign off on this when it comes time to hand them over. Now, that's not going to happen until 2032. So it's not the next president who'll decide that, but the president thereafter. And that's, of course, a risk. But that's a risk we just have to accept or to manage as best we can, because everything comes with risk. There was a huge amount of risk in our partnership that we have with the French Naval Group with the attack class submarines that we cancelled. We were dependent upon them over a multi-decade engagement and partnership for them to also deliver on certain things. That's the nature of the way these modern capabilities are. They're a risk we should be aware of, a risk we need to manage, and a risk we need to do the best we can on, but it's still a risk. And you can't avoid all risk in this unless you go down the self-sufficiency route. And the self-sufficiency route is 3 or 4 or 5 times more on defence spending as a percentage of GDP than we currently spend. And I don't think the Australian community is willing.
Yeah.
You know, the Australian community has indicated now, certainly our politicians, that they're willing to accept that relatively low level of risk for a high return, as opposed to the extraordinarily large injection of money we'd have to do this in a completely sovereignly independent, self-sufficient way, which would cost far more money. And every dollar we spend on defence to do that would be less money on roads and hospitals and universities and everything else that we do in our community.
Yeah. America has an impending election in November, and there is the chance that Trump will be elected, who I think will take a very different view on AUKUS. If he's elected, once he's caught up on it, do you have an inkling of how that could change? Would Trump look at it and go, this is a bad deal? Would he look at it and go, well, we need this to be a better deal. We need more cash injection?
It's a really important question for all of us to consider.
Mm.
I'm of the mind that if Donald Trump was elected president again, he represents probably the greatest individual risk to current US strategy, to our current mutually agreed strategy into the region. The one thing I'm pretty much sure of is that Donald Trump doesn't know exactly what Donald Trump is going to do if he wins office again. He's not laying out a policy platform in great detail. He is basically laying out a platform that's built on spite and revenge and a vision of the United States that's built around his own personal approaches to America first. And I actually think that there's only limited things we can gain by looking at the last Trump presidency, because I think he'll be very different. He'll be more Trump unleashed, which is quite a frightful consideration for those of us who believe in the rule of law and the liberal international order and democratic institutions within the United States, which he's publicly declared that he will either dismantle, attack, or threaten. Mm. But we've got to remember, he has not been elected and may not. And I said, and even if he is elected, no one knows. I don't think he knows what he's going to do. It would also be dependent upon who he puts around him. So in the US system, unlike our system, the Secretary of Defense, the Secretary of State are not elected officials. They're appointed officials. And the same through the senior levels of people in the Pentagon and in the State Department. Then let's add in Congress. Now, the US Congress is different in the way it interacts with the presidency. So they control the budget, for instance. So this proposed budget from the Pentagon that only had one Virginia-class submarine in it is a proposed budget. It's not the budget, because Congress decides on that. Mm. And when they voted for the last budget, they increased the number of submarines they were purchasing over what the Pentagon had requested. There is very strong bipartisan support for AUKUS in Congress. And in fact, we saw in the past, the more extreme elements of Trump's foreign policy was constrained by Congress passing laws saying the president couldn't do things, or saying the president might announce that, like his idea to withdraw US troops out of Korea, but passing laws in Congress saying we will not fund that. And without the money, that can't happen.
Mm, okay.
So there's a huge range of factors
that
will go into this. But I think at the moment, it's a risk. From the deal part you mentioned, Trump could look at this and go, well, Australia's paying their way and they're contributing to our industrial base, and this is a pretty good deal.
Mm-hmm.
Or he could go back and say, well, I want a better deal. I want more money. And then that will be up to an Australian government to consider where is the risk-cross ratio going in for that. But I don't think Trump knows anything about AUKUS at the moment. So we saw a data point the other day when Nigel Farage, the UK former parliamentarian, interviewed him with the famous Kevin Rudd statements now.
Yeah.
Trump clearly didn't know who Kevin Rudd was. He just fell back onto the Trump nastiness of anyone who's perceived to criticize him. And the beginning of that question started off being about AUKUS.
Trump's
look on his face was clearly blank, like he had no idea what this is.
Yep.
So Farage then pivoted to the Kevin comments, right?
Mm.
So it's not on his radar yet, and it wouldn't be on his radar until well after he's elected. And I think he'll be influenced a lot by the type of people he surrounds himself with, which we have no idea who is either. So it's conjecture at the moment.
Yep.
But certainly I hope the government is planning for the worst, and hoping for the best, not the other way around.
Every time there's a mention of AUKUS in the press or the government has something to say about AUKUS at the moment, there seems to be a lot of criticism coming up, whether it's about the spending, whether it's about the allies that we're choosing, from both sides of the spectrum, I think. So why do you think that this has become such a lightning rod for toxic feedback? And do you think that that's harmful to our defence capabilities in the long run?
Look, we live in a democracy and an open society, and contestability is critical and open debate is essential. This is a very large commitment of Australian taxpayers' dollars, potentially up to $368 billion. Therefore, it's a big project. It is the biggest defence capability project we've embarked on in Australia. So contestability has to happen. Debate is essential in an open, free and democratic society like ours. I think a couple of things. I don't think the governments, so the Morrison government who announced this and the current Albanese government who's managing this process, has done the best job in laying out a strategic case for why we need this capability and why it is essential. When governments have spoken about it, the Morrison government did as a bit of a fait accompli and then moved on like it was a done deal. And the Albanese government has been very focused on the retail politics of this about jobs. Now, it's not a job scheme. And if it is, it's one of the most inefficient job schemes in Australian history. And I think I saw a report the other day that said it's about $13 million or something per Australian job for AUKUS.
Mm.
We're not doing it for Australian jobs.
We're
doing it because of the strategic need and the defence capability. And neither government has put out a document that fully explains that, and neither government has given a comprehensive speech outlining why this capability is critical. The government needs to do a better job on informing the public of what they've signed us up to do on this capability. That's my first point I'll make. In terms of the criticism, you're right, it's become a lightning rod. And it's become a rallying cry for a lot of people who just don't like the military and don't like the United States. There is within the debate in Australia about strategic policy because of our alliance with the United States, particularly on the left of politics in Australia, there is a long stream of anti-Americanism within that. And there's been, you know, plenty of academic studies done on this, both saying, you know, it's a bad influence or it's not much of influence and everything in between. So for those people who are reflectively worried about the United States or a bit anti-Americanism, it's been an easy lightning rod for them to attach themselves to. Of course, peace activists worry about proliferation concerns and nuclear arms bases, so it's something easy for them to attach to. Now, all their motives are pure in the sense that they have a firm belief or an opposition to either nuclear reactors or the worry about peace concerns. They're legitimate concerns to have and should be debated. They need to be done on the basis of evidence, though, and not just on a philosophical belief or an ideological belief, in my view. I would also say beware of simple solutions and beware of false comparisons, because the debate is a litany of those at the moment. Mm. And one simple example, the attack class submarine with the French that we were designing, which was cancelled to be replaced by AUKUS. There was only a major piece the other day where an author quoted $100 billion and said, look how much cheaper this is than the $368 billion.
You're not accounting for the blowout, though.
Yeah, well, and it's also not accounting for. That was to build the platforms. Mm. It was not for the combat systems and not for the weapons, not for 30 or 40 years of sustainment and maintenance, and not for the crewing of the submarines. Now, when the government announced the 250, no one talks about that number, 250 to $368 billion for AUKUS, that is all inclusive. There's actually a matter of public record, and this was in a parliamentary hearing, that defence admitted that there was $90 to $100 billion for building those submarines, and then another $140 billion for that sustainment, maintenance, crewing, and whatever. That's $240 to $250 billion. Mm-hmm. That project was already late. That project was already over budget. And there are already design complications with that, and there was already a cost blowout for that. So Malcolm Turnbull, for instance, has come out numerous times making this claim that his deal, and let's face it, it was his deal as Prime Minister would have been better, but he glosses over completely all of those problems and the full cost of that. Other people have proposed, well, we'll just go and buy 24 conventional submarines that'll be better and cheaper and easier. Well, to do that, and that's Hugh White's argument, you would need not one submarine production yard, but two. So you'd have to double the number of submarine production yards and the cost. You'd have to double the number of workers we need in that yard. To crew 24 submarines, you'd need to double the number of submariners over what we're facing with the current class. And Navy has a workforce crisis at the moment. And it's not going to be any cheaper.
Mm.
But Hugh never goes into the details of that. And often people interviewing never get into the details. Where would these submarines come from? Where's the design coming from? What's the cost going to be? Because 12 submarines of the French conventional class were going to cost us about $250 billion. So 24 would cost us at least double, right? And there might be some economies of scale there. But again, if we go back to the speed endurance question, a nuclear-powered submarine can be on station 3 to 4 times longer than one of those conventional boats. So 8 to 9 nuclear-powered boats gives you as much capability as 24 conventional submarines.
Yeah.
This is a complex area of defence. Too many people are doing and glossing over it very simplistically. The same thing on the pro-AUKUS side. We can't underestimate the workforce issues that we face, both to crew these from Navy, which doesn't have enough submariners at the moment, let alone for more and bigger submarines with a greater crew. The workforce issues that we have in Australia, we do not have enough workers in Australia, particularly engineers, university-trained STEM people and tradespeople, to do a clean energy transition, to build nuclear-powered submarines, and to continue our oil and gas sector and our minerals and resources sector.
Mm.
We have the lowest unemployment rate in nearly 50 years. We have a skills crisis in this country. And we can't get those workers from the United States and the United Kingdom because they don't have enough working in their own submarine area as well. So we shouldn't underestimate that we can just easily do this either.
Mm. Yeah.
So
yeah.
It's a complex debate. Some people are in it because of their own personal perceived views of things. But those who are largely opposed to AUKUS, I would say it's perfectly fine to have an opposition. It should be grounded in evidence. And I would really call on those people, what is the alternative that relates to policy and strategic need and is properly costed and properly funded and worked through? And I would say at the moment in the debate where we are, AUKUS is a bipartisan, rock-solid bipartisan commitment. Depending on the polls, it has somewhere between 50 and 70% of support. So the Lowy poll puts it at around 68% support. Some of the polls that we've done have put it at around 50%. I would find it amazing that a government doesn't follow through on this. Then the question really about is the contestability about how we can deliver it. Are we getting value for money? Can this actually happen? And what are the adjustments we need to make? And what are the alternatives if they're at all viable if this thing doesn't go well? That's where the debate, I think, could and should be at. I have real concerns about people who are putting the debate out because of their own personal political interests, an ideological factor that ignores a lot of evidence on the ground.
Mm.
And one of them is, for instance, well, these submarines are longer range and long endurance, so what we're really going to do is use them to fight a war against China over Taiwan. Now, there's no evidence for that. It defies declared Australian policy. It defies what the government's statements have made around sovereignty and around the use of these submarines, and defines what the Defence Strategic Review outlined what we're going to do for them. So if you're going to really argue that case, you're kind of pushing yourself into the realm of conspiracy theories here now. So people have to be very careful about it, but contestability is key and debate is essential in a free and open democratic society. And rightfully, every Australian taxpayer should be asking the government to justify this capability, both on a strategic need and a cost basis, and give the community regular updates on how it's going, and to be able to answer those contested questions. And I think all sides of the debate can probably do a better job at that.
That was Professor Peter Dean, Director of Foreign Policy and Defence at the United States Studies Centre at the University of Sydney, and you have been listening to Asia Rising, a podcast from La Trobe Asia. If you like this podcast, please subscribe to it, send a link to your friends, or leave a review. You can follow La Trobe Asia on LinkedIn or what is left of Twitter. We are at La Trobe Asia. And Peter Dean is at Defence Prof. Asia Rising is a podcast from La Trobe Asia, produced at La Trobe University in Melbourne, Australia, on the traditional lands of the Wurundjeri people. I'm Matt Smith, and thanks for listening.